This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age Masterclass Podcast with host Ben Morse. Episode 12, 1968, Part 2 with Nick Duke.
Didn't quite remember that you were coming by. This is a little awkward.
What's going on, man?
I am Ben Morse. Yeah. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, you're here? Oh, is this here. The bit? Are we doing the bit?
I don't know what's happening right now.
I was doing a little routine. I was going to bring you in gradually. All right, whatever. Let's dispense with the formalities. I'm Ben Morse. This is Marvel Age Masterclass. You already heard me. Nick Duke is here, and he is ready to go. Brother, you are laced up and all set for some conversation about comics, huh?
Absolutely. As we were discussing before we came on the air, I'm recovering from a cold right now. My energy level is absolutely at an all-time high, as you've probably heard on recent episodes of the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
I'm actually a couple episodes behind on Hard Traveling Fanboys. I'm still in the throes of Aquamonth.
Ah.
I just rounded the corner on hearing your ignorant feelings on Connor Kent Superboy, Greg's lack of any sort of context for New Teen Titans. As I stated on social media, Hard Traveling Fanboys has become a carousel of disappointment for me.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
People I care about and like letting me down week by week.
Hey,
and I just trudge through it.
You'll be happy to know I haven't done so yet, but I am planning on picking up that first issue of Young Justice that just dropped, though. So I will at least be supporting the return of Connor Kent. Yeah, I saw on Twitter you had good things to say about it.
Yeah, I checked it out. If you're a fan of the old Young Justice series, I went to my store. I picked it up because I really think Bendis has been rejuvenated at DC, mm-hmm. and obviously I love these characters. It was one of those things where I knew it was going to be a good comic because it's Bendis and Gleason and it's characters I love, but I didn't realize until I read it how much I had missed these characters, and they just kind of bring me back to a point in my life where there was just that innocence and joy of the comics. So it's really fun. I don't know if you'll have the same experience because obviously I don't think you have the same connection with the Young Justice characters. But just as far as being a good comic, it's a good comic. So I think you'll dig it.
Well, and I'm kind of looking for something like Bendis from characters in that age range. You kind of recapturing a little bit of that voice of Ultimate Spider-Man is kind of what I'm looking for. So if it has any of that, I'm sure I'll enjoy it.
Sure, I didn't think of that. That's true. I was just saying the other day, I threw it out there randomly that, do you remember the period of Ultimate Spider-Man? The thing I love about Bendis on Ultimate Spider-Man was whenever things got a little too stagnant, mm-hmm. he would completely change the status quo,
right?
Which I loved. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking how much I loved that period where it was it basically became a whole book, and you had Iceman, Human Torch, Gwen Stacy, Kitty Pryde, they were all living in the Parker house.
It was the period right after Ultimatum, which the less said about mm-hmm. Ultimatum, the better. But when they relaunched it at number one as Ultimate Comic Spider-Man for the first time.
Right.
And it was an issue of the book that was not drawn by either Mark Bagley or Stuart Immonen. I can't remember who the artist on it was, but I do know that the art style was
David
LaFuente was drastically different.
Yeah.
And that took me a long time to get used to. And by the time I got used to it, they brought Bagley back on to do Death of Spider-Man. So it was it was an interesting time, but I enjoyed the storytelling of that time period as well because you kind of had a little time jump and you had some things to play with in terms of what had happened in the months since Ultimatum and all that. So yeah, I was in on that as well. And they had done a good job of doing it. I remember there being some really good Kitty Pryde stuff going on at that time
really
as well. Cause there's an argument to be made that for the entire Ultimate Universe, she was probably the character who was allowed to grow and develop the most if you read the entire from beginning to end as one story. So I've always loved Bendis' work on Kitty from the Ultimate books. But this is not, sadly, an Ultimate Universe podcast as much as I wish it was.
We'll do that someday. I'll tell you, I'll say publicly, because I couldn't at the time, that it drove me freaking nuts when they retitled them Ultimate Comics, whatever. I don't know why. It just bugged me.
Well,
I was working there, and I was like, why are we doing this?
I'll tell you why it bugs you, because there was a book on the shelf called Ultimate Comics New Ultimates. That's why.
Yeah. Ultimate Comics New Ultimates, Ultimate Comics X.
Yep.
Like that. Oh. I was like, weird. I was just, it's driving nuts. I was just like, Ultimate is such a successful brand. I never understood, like, just keep it, leave it how it is. It was the same way that after New Avengers hit, and suddenly everyone knew this, knew that, like, new X-Men, yeah. New Invaders was the tipping point for me. I was like, New Invaders? What? It's just Invaders. It's going to get canceled in 12 issues anyways, whatever, regardless.
It also didn't help that the Ultimate Comics rebranding came right after Ultimatum, which was like the blow to the Ultimate Universe that the line would never recover from.
And all the best I can say about Ultimatum is that Jeff Loeb is a very nice man.
There you go. I'm sure he is. I've always heard good things.
That's all I had to say. He's always been very kind to me.
Right.
Very kind to me. So let's leave it at that. Anyways, the point of this podcast is not to talk about Marvel Comics from 10 years ago, but Marvel Comics from several decades ago. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you guys over on Marvel Age are making your way year through year. And over here on Masterclass, I hope you guys have a group, and we break things together. We analyze things a little bit more. It's been a little while. I was looking at my phone. I don't think talk since November, when we did part 168. And then I know over the holidays, you know, people get busy, things get happening, so slow down a little bit. But Marvel Age came back with part 2 of 1968, and so here we are with part 2 of 1968 on Masterclass. Actually, the last time we talked was the day after Stan Lee died.
Oh my God, yeah, you're right. I'm remembering that now as you say that. It has been a little bit, but you know, like you said, the holidays are always busy, so it's kind of good to get away from things for a little while, but now I'm ready to talk some Marvel Comics with you.
And let's compliment you and Greg for, despite the holidays, keeping the content coming over on your podcast. Even some days I'm sure you didn't want to get out of bed and record Hard Traveling Fanboys. God, you kept that streak alive. So God bless you guys. Podcasts.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. It was tough. Greg had to find out a way to squeeze in a screening of Aquaman during his family gatherings and stuff, but he worked it out and we got it in. So we were happy to see.
So I haven't seen Aquaman yet. I haven't seen Spider-Verse yet.
Oh, now, okay, like Aquaman.
The Aquaman one's whatever, but the Spider-Verse one's like truly offensive, I know.
You gotta see Spider-Verse. I've seen it twice already. It's remarkable.
So I've got an 18-month-old. You're a little ahead of me on the kids track.
Right.
So I'm still like relatively in the new parent thing where going out is still a luxury.
Yes.
And the problem I face is that if I get a night to go out, I generally want to do something with my wife. I like her.
Right.
And I want to spend time with her. And I burned her out so much on Marvel movies during the 10 years I was there that the last thing she wants to do when we have a free night is go see a movie based on a Marvel comic book. So trying to start going to see Spider-Verse has been an uphill battle. One, I don't think I'm going to win, unfortunately. So it may not be till it comes on demand that I see it. She did actually say, she's like, oh, I can't wait to see that on demand. Like, dug the knife in there.
If it helps, just tell her, like, from a technical standpoint, there has never been an animated movie like this at all. Even if you care nothing about Spider-Man. If you like animation, this is a must-see.
I've come at it from every conceivable angle. I've explained to her that my friends who care nothing for comics are telling us the literal best movies they have ever seen. Like, divorced from comic books, divorced from animation, just like one of the best movies.
Mm-hmm.
And she is just unmoved. She wants to go get dinner or something. So that's what we'll do. She runs the show.
I got you.
But I'll see it eventually. I haven't listened to that pod blast with Greg and whoever talking about it yet. Was it Greg and Russell?
I think it was Greg and Russell, yeah.
Sound right. And then I just finished your episode on Peter David Volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll get to the Aquaman review soon. See, what I'm doing is I'm actually, believe it or not, I'm teaching podcasting this semester.
Yeah, you told me that.
It's a new class. Right. So I told you that. So it's a new class for me. So what I'm doing, I may have already told you this too, is that I'm trying to listen to as many different podcasts as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas in the past, I would have just, you know, weekly I listen to you guys, I listen to Place to Be, I get all the ones I go, you know, fitting in like, you know, oh, Bill Simmons is important. Mm-hmm. I should probably listen to his podcast.
Right.
Like stuff like that. So it's taking me a little longer to get to it. But always an enjoyable listen when I do get to it.
Awesome. Good to hear. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
All right. So let's head back in 1968. The thing that's most interesting to me as I was kind of reviewing today and thinking about what we were going to talk about is that with the history of Marvel Comics, you have some stuff early on that really hits as like the classic stuff. And I think primarily of Spider-Man and Fantastic Four being kind of the standout. I think something we've discovered as we moved along here has been Thor was consistently good earlier than people might have thought.
Right.
And the other discovery was the quality of Doctor Strange.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big unearthing. But there is kind of that period past the initial hits that I feel like there's been a little bit of a valley.
Mm-hmm.
Like stuff like the Galactus trilogy aside, but even thinking back to like 1968 part one, we talked about all those crappy Avengers and how things have just been kind of trailing off. I think with the stuff we're going to talk about tonight, in particular, two books that I want to talk about first, I think this is kind of like the new classics, for lack of a better term. Like, you get the next wave of really good stuff. And it's divided up by some stuff Stan and Jack and the familiar faces are doing. But then, of course, we get one major new voice integrated as well. But as we kind of sprint towards the season, it sounds like, okay, so it's not just going to be Fantastic Four and Spider-Man are always okay, and everything else is kind of a failed experiment. Some things actually start to hit, and that's very refreshing to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned it. Stan is starting to kind of diversify a little bit as it relates to the bullpen. More artistic looks, a greater diversity of just kind of a feel across the line. Yeah, it still kind of feels like, you know, Silver Age Marvel, but there's a little bit of differentiation there. And that's helped to be a good thing. But, I mean, I have to imagine that Stan and Jack in the early days were stretched so thin that probably hurt some stuff like Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos, which we kind of were not all that positive on a few years back. So, yeah, getting some new blood in here, especially on Nick Fury, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, it absolutely played a huge role.
I want to hit Nick Fury second. I want to first talk about what Stan was up to. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that we obviously in our last episode talked a lot about Stan, but it was cool that it dovetailed into the fact that the Silver Surfer solo series, say that three times fast.
Yeah.
The Silver Surfer solo series by Stan and John Buscema, which we got the first few issues in this reading, is some of my favorite stuff from early Marvel. And it's interesting because I didn't grow up as a huge Silver Surfer fan.
Same.
And I think part of that is because once you get past his early appearances and you go into how he was kind of used in the 80s and the 90s, he becomes more of kind of a generic space.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, there's not a lot to it. Like, you know, God bless Jim Starlin and Ron Mars and the guys who were writing him in the 90s. But when I was a kid, Silver Surfer just held no appeal for me. When I got a little older, I read this original stuff that Stan was doing. It was revelatory.
Mm-hmm.
And what's most interesting to me is that he immediately, when you guys on your show encountered him in the Galactus trip, beneath the powers, beneath the godliness, this is where he came from. And in some ways, make him like the other Marvel heroes, in a way, because we get to see his personal flaws, you know, his problems on Zen La, and his relationship with Shalabal, all the things that make him a little more human. But the thing that sets him apart, and that I think distinguishes Silver Surfer, not just where you can clearly see that he's Stan's favorite character, but also just show why he has staying power, is his whole origin story is rooted in heroic sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
It's the inverse of something like Spider-Man, Peter Parker, where he screws up and something terrible happens. Or, you know, any of these Marvel heroes who are so flawed and they kind of recover by being superheroes. With Norrin Radd, he does this incredibly noble, like, sacrificing thing in becoming the Silver Surfer. He saves his whole planet. So, from the start, he's kind of a hero. But then, there's also that angle to him of, well, he just wanted to get off Zen Law and explore the universe. So, he's a complex character. And I guess what I was most impressed by when I first read the first bits of the Silver Surfer ongoing series was just the fact that Stan was willing to take a chance and not just stick with, this is the formula that works for this character, I'm just going to keep it going, but now he's the star. He kind of flipped the script, and I think made him a much more interesting character.
Yeah, I would agree. I think also one thing that's notable is, unlike the other Marvel heroes, he has no moment. There's no opportunity for him ever to being Norrin Rat again. Like, he is trapped within this identity of the Silver Surfer no matter what. Even Bruce Banner gets moments as Bruce Banner. You know, Peter Parker can walk around as a normal, same for the Fantastic Four. Norrin Rat has no opportunity of ever returning to his normal life. And then when you combine it with the kind of deal he made with Galactus in the Galactus trilogy that sees him confined to Earth, he can't even explore the cosmos anymore, which was kind of, like you said, his primary motivation for making that sacrifice in the first place. So he's kind of really lost everything and is here on Earth with a people that, as they point out throughout these three issues, don't really deserve him and don't really deserve his knowledge and his nobility at this point. So it makes for a really interesting exploration of that character here in these first few issues.
It feels like it's almost kind of like next level Stan at this point. I think you guys talked a lot about it on Marvel Ages episode, that this is probably, to this point, Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Doctor Strange, Thor aside, this may be the best stuff Stan's ever done. It has a different feel. It's not bouncy and fun. Like, it's very serious. It's very emotional. And it feels like he's answering and tackling big questions, like stuff about social issues that are larger than just get on man or medicine or whether or not the Fantastic Four gets along. Like, this is big, important stuff. He uses Surfer as kind of his window to humanity. And like you just said, Nick, some of the things that Stan says via the Surfer and his journey about humanity are not the best stuff. It's not that, like, I feel like in superhero comics, the ultimate is always like, well, people are good. They'll always eventually rise and do the right thing. And, you know, aren't we great? But Silver Surfer is a comic that really says, like, you know what? Humanity is flawed at best. And you said it perfectly. We don't deserve someone as good as the Silver Surfer. His sacrifices that he's made, the hero that he is, is better than us. And it's a very interesting way to read a comic, because you're a character who really is better than everyone else. And what becomes interesting is, how long can he stay that way? As he's, you know, just as pettiness and selfishness of humanity, can he stay so pure of motive, and can he stay this superheroic figure? And as we get into this, it's a question of whether or not he can. You see him literally love the fact that they bring in Mephisto as a villain, as a new villain, and it's literally like, this is a guy who's so good that, oh yeah, obviously he can resist the tentacle devil, but we encounter him at a point in his hero's journey where there's more of a question. You know, maybe he will take Mephisto's deal. Maybe he will turn his back on humanity. Maybe he wants to see his girlfriend again. Like, it's a really nuanced mix for some of the best comics of the Silver Age, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would completely agree. You know, that Mephisto angle, like you said, which is kind of the high point of the three issues, in my opinion. It's a great dichotomy, though, character. Someone who is the Marvel representation of the literal devil juxtaposed against this figure who is, like we said, just so noble and so selfless that it makes for really interesting comics. And, you know, these first three issues are just another example of how, when people say that they just want their comics to go back to not making political comments or commenting on social issues,
right,
they're kind of full of crap, because it's been there since the inception of the modern superhero comic as we know it.
Absolutely. Yeah, Silver Surfer as a comic was something to say, like, for sure. And, you know, it talks about hypocrisy and, you know, defamation and just bias and, you know, the horrible things about humanity. They're all right there in Silver Surfer comics, and they're expressing. You're right. Comics were complex, and that's something we've seen throughout this journey. We've seen that, you know, whether it's Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, even Avengers and X-Men, like, they're willing to look at things that are a mirror of society, a mirror of politics, a mirror of social issues, and it's all right there on the page. I think there's definitely – what's interesting to me if you analyze Silver Surfer, even talking about him the way we've been talking about him, clearly there's some religious stuff going on here. I think Stan's definitely saying some stuff about, you know, whether he is a savior figure and stuff like that. But what I liked is you don't get beat over the head with it.
No.
It's not overwhelming. It's not pushing everything else aside. At the end of the day, this is still a superhero comic.
Right.
And there might be allegories and allusions to spiritual things, but that's not the main point. The main point is just this is a story about good versus evil, and it's aspirational in the sense that don't you want to be the good guy? Don't you want to live up to the expectations that the Silver Surfer lays down?
Absolutely. At no point does it turn into, you know, a bad religious metaphor, which sometimes I think Superman stories have been notorious for over the years, of beating that Jesus thing, you know, or the Moses metaphor sometimes, either of those into the ground a little bit. This strays away from that, which is a positive.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other half of this I want to talk about is John Buscema. I talked about him on the podcast before when we were talking about Avengers comics. One of my favorites. But while he was good on Avengers and we find his footing in some other comics, he's great on Conan in particular. I think his Silver Surfer is tremendous.
It's outstanding.
I think Kirby created this great design and Buscema just ran with it. He really wanted to do the simplicity of the Surfer's design. He's able to do it justice. He creates these incredibly heroic figures. Mephisto is terrifying. Shalabal is beautiful. Like, everything he does is just on point and just one very favorite parts of the Silver Age. At the risk of repeating myself, because he was able to do big, powerful action without looking like a Jack Kirby knockoff or a Steve Ditko knockoff or even a John Romero. He had his own voice. He had his own style. And I like that when Stan decided he was going to launch Silver Surfer, this is the guy he chose for the job. Back to the point that we were making at the beginning, new voices, new looks. I think he was saying, you know what? Silver Surfer is a popular character. I care that this is going to be impactful. I'm not just going to use one of the old standbys here. This is going to be a chance to shine a spotlight on a guy who's been doing great work on Avengers, but can really break out on his own and establish who he is with this comic book.
Absolutely. I mean, he, like you said, doesn't attempt to do a Jack Kirby impersonation, which is probably the best thing he possibly could have done. And his designs, where he gets to imagine, you know, Zen Law or the chamber with Galactus, where he actually becomes a Silver Surfer, stuff like that, is just outstandingly visualized and realized. I mean, that's all original designs. You know, when he's on Earth, he has to kind of make things look like, you know, we would expect them to look. But other places with the outer space stuff, with the galactic stuff, it's really a free reign and he's able to be creative. And it shows here, it's really outstanding work.
I also like thing that's a little understated is, to your point, what you were talking about when he's on Earth, is that Surfer out. Like, he's always, like, stands out from the crowd, but not to the point, like, oh my god, look really bizarre. Like, you can understand how he could, I guess what I'm getting at, you can understand how he could walk among humans with Buscema's art, but you also get that sense that humans encounter the Silver Surfer via the art, via the visuals we're seeing. It's a big deal. Like, this is a guy who just is awe-inspiring. And it's a powerfully written comic. It's a powerfully drawn comic. To me, it's one of the best of this era of the late 60s. The interesting thing is, I don't know how much more Silver Surfer we get to read, if any. But there's not a lot of it. It doesn't last for very long.
Right.
And I'd actually like to dig into that and figure out why. I don't know if it was sales. I don't know if it was Stan getting stretched too thin. But it's a short-lived series. I remember reading the Marvel Masterworks, and it was basically collected in one volume.
Right.
So it kind of shines very brightly. And we'll see as a recurring theme in the next book we're going to talk about as well, that some of these books that came out towards the tail end of the 60s are great, but they don't stick around for extended periods of time.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. It's kind of notable that here are the two best new contributions from 1968. Neither of them are around for very long.
Right, and that we should move on to, obviously, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh.
Very incredible stuff. great stuff, but very different in the sense that Silver Surfer, just looking behind the scenes before we get into the characters and the in-universe stuff, but looking behind the scenes, the people creating the book, Silver Surfer was Stan getting to tell a story you really wanted to tell, Stan really getting to shine almost a decade into the Marvel Universe and finding new things to say. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., Jim Steranko, writing and drawing, completely new voice. And one of the first people by Marvel, mm-hmm. and to that extension by Stan, to tell his own story and to have his own voice. And as a result, Nick Fury looks and sounds different than anything else Marvel has produced to this point. And I think something is a lot of the books that have kind of fallen by the wayside, Daredevil as kind of a Spider-Man knockoff, mm-hmm. Avengers as being a pale version of what Fantastic Four was. Nick Fury is a book that it's not an imitation of anything else. It's purely original stuff. And I love the fact that Steranko was just so good in the Nick Fury strip on Strange Tales that even just the years we've been talking about it, you saw the evolution of him being the artist on a Nick Fury strip that ran in half a book, to him being the writer and artist on that strip, to him being the writer and artist on Nick Fury's own full title. So this is also kind of cool in the sense that it's one of the first earliest examples of kind of like fans voting with their dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people liked what Steranko was doing on Nick Fury, so he got control of the character, and he got his own series. And he wasn't relegated to, you know, Hasbro's anymore. So, it's really interesting to look at. Nick Fury by Steranko, you guys kind of nailed it. I'm not going to belabor the point on why it's good, but I think just, again, that the feel of the fact that it's almost a misnomer that it's called Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., in my opinion. Because I think what Steranko recognized was Nick Fury on his own, maybe not the most dynamic character, not really a leading man who had been on, and we've talked about that. But when you start to create a world around him, mm-hmm. when you start to create the world of S.H.I.E.L.D., the world of Hydra, this huge shadow war that's gone from these two super spy agencies, and you get these big set pieces, whether it's the helicarrier or all these other things that are going on, and you just have a cast of crazy off-the-wall villains and supporting characters, then you got something special. And Nick Fury can be anyone. I mean, in the way that James Bond's a great character, but I think if he doesn't have the colorful villains and the gadgets and the girls, he doesn't work as well. I think you see the same thing with Nick Fury, and I think Steranko really wasn't interested in writing a book about a spy, interested in creating an entire world. And that's what he did.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it perfectly. And as we said on Marvel Age, it's so hard to talk about this work because while he definitely is able to the voice of Nick Fury, I think the driving force behind this really is the art. And it's unlike anything we've seen to this point in the Marvel Universe. I mean, unique does not even begin to describe it. It's something that we struggle to talk about, how inventive it was, whether it be page layouts, lettering even, facial reactions, just everything about it screamed different. And I think that, more so than anything else, is probably what led the fans to vote with their dollar each about, because it really felt like you were picking up something that you could not get anywhere else in the world in terms of a pop culture creation. It's that dynamic. It really makes me wonder, why did we get so little of this? I mean, why are there only, I believe, like 5 issues that Steranko was that complete elf? I don't know. It's one of those things I'll always wonder about.
Yeah, I think the thing with Steranko was he was probably the earliest Marvel creator who was just fiercely independent and wanted to do his own thing. Because if you think about it, up to this point, like, everyone who worked on a Marvel book, or a DC book for that matter, like, they needed the work. And, like, you know, Kirby wasn't going to go anywhere yet because they needed the work. I think Steranko had enough of a independent streak in him and
an established character. Not that Nick Fury wasn't established, but like he kind of had this canvas to paint a wholly original creation with Nick Fury, because Nick Fury was something of a floundering character. There wasn't really, I don't think, a real carved out place for him in the larger Marvel universe to this point. So it's interesting that he goes from this on to do something like Captain America before leaving full time. It's just Soranko is one of those guys. It's always interesting to look back on and wonder, you know, what the comics landscape might have looked like had he been more involved throughout his career.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's the type of thing also where with Soranko, those last couple of years, it's kind of like a push and pull relationship. It's like, hey, well, maybe you can come back to do Captain America. Wouldn't you like to do Captain America? Oh, yeah, I love Captain America. Come back. Oh, it's still the same old, you know, same old shit. It's the same old, I can't do what I want to do, so I'm going to do 2 issues of Captain America. I'm going to bolt. Then a few years later, like, hey, you should do a cover. Does a cover. They're hoping he's going to come back full-time. I don't know. I just think it's like a caged bird, man. That bird was meant to fly. That bird was meant to be free. And Jim Steranko was that bird who just needed to fly. So we didn't get as much as he wanted. But, yeah, that's really interesting that you propose it because I wonder if he had stuck around, if he had had, like, a long, definitive run. I mean, look how definitive his run on Nick Fury was with only a few issues.
Right.
Imagine if he had stuck around for, you know, 5-10 years. Let me throw this at you. Would we remember him less fondly? Because kind of the benefit of him only being around such a brief time on Nick Fury is he didn't really get a chance to put out anything bad. I mean, you guys talked about a little bit, like the horror issue is not the best.
Mm-hmm.
But he sticks around for 5 years. Maybe we get a lot more of those. Like maybe we'll never know. We don't know how much story he had to tell. So we get to remember him fondly because it's like, oh, he came in, he did a bunch of kick-ass issues, and then he left. He didn't accumulate any bad stuff. So in that sense, like, it's almost like leaving early protects his legacy.
That's a good point. Although I guess I kind of wish I had seen – we had gotten to see, like, maybe his need – for change, channeled in a different direction where maybe he just kind of hopped around from book to book for a little while. That would have been cool.
Yeah,
like to see him kind of do a tour throughout the universe. Like specifically, I'm sitting here thinking about the idea of Steranko doing a little run on Doctor Strange, and that just sounds amazing, especially with the Doctor Strange from this era that we've kind of praised so heavily on the show here. So, you know, all things considered, got to be happy for what we got. And that, like we said earlier, this stuff is just iconic. No other way to describe it.
Next level, he creates the kind of the other Nick Fury villain in Scorpio, who I think is just a cool villain. There's some high concept stuff that comes with Scorpio later. I forget who did it, but just a cool design, pretty badass villain. You know, Baron Strucker will always be the main Nick Fury villain, kind of the alpha dog, but Scorpio was a nice introduction by Steranko. It was cool. He dropped so much stuff. This is what it's crazy to think about. Think about the fact that, you know, as you guys are fond of quoting me, Stan and Jack always created a lot of stuff for that were gifts for later writers that were stuff to play with. Think about how much they left over the course of their 100-plus issues of Fantastic Four that people still play with. Steranko in just like 5, 10, 15 issues of Nick Fury over the course of Strange Tales and into Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. creates all these concepts that like later creators would just run with, whether it's Baron Strucker, the supporting cast, the visual stuff he did, the weapons. It was just like he really populated a world very quickly. The only person I can think of who is somewhat similar is what Kirby would later do at DC with New Gods, where he just, you know, out of nowhere created dozens of characters, but it feels like that's kind of what Steranko is doing here.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, he made an indelible mark. You can't really argue that. Great comparison there with Kirby. So, you know, it like I said, we can always wish for more, but we got to be grateful for what we got, and what we got was amazing.
Well, the comparison with Kirby is apt because I think in my mind, it's not a coincidence. I think Steranko had an influence on Kirby because I think Kirby, at this point, Kirby always wanted to do his own stuff. There's no question about that. You can see him kind of like chafing and wanting to, you know, run the show. I got to wonder if he sees a guy like Steranko kind of take his ball and leave and think like, you know what, maybe I could do that. And in a few years, we'll see it. So I think I feel like there's more of a connection, and this is me not being a, you know, as good a comic book historian as I should be. So I don't know what the relationship was between Kirby and Steranko, but I just got to speculate that there was some sort of connection there. I feel like Kirby had to admire him in a way. And also just because their art styles are not totally dissimilar. There's definitely some influence one to the other.
Right. Yeah, I can totally see that. I mean, Sirocco to me is a little bit more daring and inventive with stuff like structure and layouts. But yeah, if you're actually analyzing like the content of the panels, there's definitely some similarities. So I can see
Absolutely.
That.
Yeah. So we're done with Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. As far as the next few years, right? Or do we have more?
No, this is all on our reading list because, you know, Sirocco is gone. After five issues. So we have some Sirocco Captain America on our list for 1969, right, and that's it.
Well, that'll be good. We look forward to that.
Yep.
But we have a few other things to discuss tonight. We talked Silver Surfer and Nick Fury, which are the big ones, obviously, here. But there were some other books we read. I want to talk about Amazing Spider-Man Annual.
Okay.
First and foremost,
Here's one that we talked about on Marvel Age. By the way, you just mentioned, you know, Stan and Jack creating the oft-quoted gift for later writers. So since you kind of coined that term, let's ask you, what's the opposite of that? What's something that Stan drops in that other writers have tried to touch on that we wish that they would just leave the hell alone? Because I'm going to argue, no one has ever tried to incorporate Peter's parents into a story and made it good since this.
Yeah. I mean, it's the bag of shit that Stan leaves for later creators.
Okay.
And what can you do with a bag of shit
The flaming bag on the door, huh?
The flaming bag on the door, and they're just like, oh, well, I got to do something with this. I guess I'll, put it in the stove. I'll say this, man. I have never been a fan of the idea that Peter Parker's parents were these secret agent spies. I didn't like it when Stan did it. I didn't like it in the Ultimate Universe. I didn't like it in the movies.
Nope.
I never liked it because to me, there are some characters in comics who are a little bit more fluid, a little bit more malleable, that you can drop them into different kinds of genres and they work. And I would argue like the best example I think of that is Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can put Wolverine in a Western, in a samurai story, in a sci-fi story. He always works. He's a great character that can just kind of, like, go from genre to genre. Same with even, like, Batman. Like, Batman can do a detective story. He can do an action story. He can do a sci-fi story. With Spider-Man, it's so integral to what makes him work that he is, like, this grounded mm-hmm. character that anytime they try to strain, and you know, I experienced this, of course, in the 90s when they were doing the Clone Saga, because the Clone Saga was like this crazy off the wall, like some months it was science stuff, which kind of worked because his origin is sciencey, but then they would do these like crazy conspiracies, or they would even try to incorporate like mystical elements and stuff like that. And I was just like, no, man. I was like, it's fine to see Spider-Man once in a while come up against like a magical threat or something, and he teams up with Doctor Strange to stop it, and that's cool because it's like, oh, it's so weird to see Spider-Man doing this. But when you take something that's like pretty ingrained in the tapestry of who Spider-Man is, that being his parents, and you say, oh, they were secret agents and they fucking died fighting the Red Skull or whatever. I mean, it's cool that Red Skull shows up in this issue. That's about the best thing that happens. But it's just like, I don't know. I don't dig it. I don't like that there is this element of Peter Parker that is just beyond being the average normal kid. I don't know. That's my personal opinion. I didn't like when they brought him back in the 90s, obviously. I think that's what you're referring to. Anything they've done with the parents, like post this annual, has never been good, but I didn't even like it here. Like, it's fine. It's competently written. It's finely drawn, but I was never a fan of the concept.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, you mentioned the movies, like specifically the Ultimate Universe, the movie version of the Ultimate Universe, the Amazing films, directed by Mark Webb, where he had like this fascination with this mysterious backstory of Peter's dad. Like, Peter Parker is an interesting character in and of himself, and I would argue that part of what makes his, you know, his parentage interesting is that Peter was so young, he never really had a chance to know his parents. They're kind of this blank slate in his mind. He doesn't really have this these great memories of them. And I would argue that trying to fill in those blanks kind of reduces what makes Peter's backstory unique a little bit. So, yeah, I've never liked it either. Lots of people have tried to touch on it, it feels like, since this. And I kind of wish this had just never really been touched on in the first place.
Yeah, I like the point you made that I think there's something special about the fact that, you know, he doesn't know his parents. And, like, we can make up whatever we want to in our heads. Like,
right.
His parents were this, his parents were that. Like, just leave it up to your imagination. And also, I would say it diminishes Aunt May and Uncle Ben somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have this looming shadow of these crazy, like, big characters hanging over them. And to me, you nailed it, man. When you just said, like, Peter's an interesting enough character, he does not need to have this mysterious, mythical backstory of his father. And I love most of what Bendis did with Ultimate Spider-Man, I wasn't really into when he tried to make the whole, like, you know, the conspiracy with Peter's dad.
Oh, and the Venom and the
Venom suit. And all that stuff. I was just like, I felt like that was, it wasn't necessary. It was better than this, but it still didn't feel like it was needed to me. So, end of the day, I think Spider-Man's a street-level character. He's relatable because you could be this kid. The minute you start making his parents, like, agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or whatever they were, then I can no longer relate to Spider-Man. Because I can't relate to Peter Parker because my parents are not secret agents,
right.
as most comic readers' parents are not. So the more fantastical elements you add to his life, I just think that takes him further away. Ironically, I think one of the things I loved about Peter Parker is I love the Peter Parker and Mary Jane relationship, which I think you do as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the argument people who were against the marriage used One of the arguments was, oh, well, him being married to a supermodel takes him too far away from being, like, the average kid, which I don't agree with, but I understand where they're coming from. That, of all the arguments against the marriage, that was the one I was like, all right, I can kind of see where you're coming from there.
Yeah, I can kind of see that to a degree, but I would argue that, like, Peter's a guy who his entire life is defined by tragedy, that something good in his life was kind of warranted by that point. And also, like, to me, that reduces Mary Jane a little bit and say, oh, well, she's just the supermodel. You know, that makes it unrealistic for her to be with somebody like Peter when they had had a defined, you know, relationship and she had had a character before supermodel for decades leading up to that point. So it just, you know, if anything, the argument there to me is don't have her become a literal supermodel more so than don't have the two get married because, you know, getting married is a natural part of, you know, growing up and aging and moving forward for a lot of people. And so,
right.
If anything, to me, that makes Peter more relatable. But that is an argument and a rabbit hole we can spend plenty of time on.
We'll get there. I agree with you, though. I think that it's a relationship that it was earned by the time they got there. It wasn't like they introduced this super hot character and married her off to Peter within a year. She'd been around for years. Anyways, we'll get back to that. We'll pick that up sometime in 2030 when we get to it. But yeah, that's all I really have to say about Amazing Spider-Man. I don't like this annual just because of what it does. Nothing against the quality of it.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it was not one of Stan's better ideas in my view.
Absolutely.
So let's move on to a character who, to me, the backstory, the origin, the elements, everything about this character is more interesting than the character itself. And I'm, of course, referring to Captain Marvel,
mm-hmm.
Mar-Vell,
mm-hmm.
The character created so that Marvel could trademark a name. So here's the thing, man. I'm going to go a little bit of a tangent here. When I was growing up, the two characters who, to me, were just kind of like these dull but, like, somehow legendary characters were Mar-Vell and Barry Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And I always compare them to each other because I think they contrast in the sense that they both achieved in being dead characters a far greater and more legendary status than they did from being alive. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not fair to compare them directly because I do think Barry Allen was a good character in his early years, and then I think he faltered a little bit because I don't think, in my opinion, and you can listen to, I think me and Todd did a pop blast on the different Flashes, and I talked about why traditional Barry is just not my cup of tea, but I think Barry, the coolest thing he ever did was die in Crisis. Mm-hmm. He has an amazing death scene, and it's just like, oh my god, like, the motivation he gives Wally, everything moving forward, great. With Mar-Vell, it's the same deal. Like, I don't know. Have you read the Death of Captain Marvel graphic novel?
I have not. I have not. But it's not that far away, honestly. Yeah. We're starting to get up on it.
So it's a great story. And it's a great story by Jim Starlin. And it's mm-hmm. great in the sense that it's so unique because it's just this heroic figure lying in bed dying of cancer. So it's like, wow. Like, the fact that they took the bravery to do that, or like just the idea to do that, like, it's a great story. And Captain Marvel by the 90s as kind of this sainted character who is so great because he died heroically, and you know, he never really stuck around to, you know, experience the 90s, so to say, that was cool. And with both Barry and Mar-Vell, as I got older and went from being, you know, a kid comic book reader to a teenage comic book reader and actually, like, looking at backish and stuff, I was fascinated by both of them. And I really wanted to find the stuff that was good, the stuff that made them worthy of their kind of death stories. And with Barry, again, I think some of the Silver Age Flash stories are really fun. There's some really cool stuff. The problem is he's such a Silver Age character that once you get out of the Silver Age, he doesn't age as well. With Mar-Vell, as we see here, I don't know that there were ever really good Captain Marvel stories. Mm-hmm. I know Starlin does some stuff at some point, which I'm looking for because I've never read it. Mm-hmm. He does, like, some crazy cosmic stuff in the 70s, so maybe there. But with me, it's just like, this Captain Marvel that we got to read this time, it's just throwing so many things at the wall.
Right.
Like, it's just like, he's an alien, but right. He likes Earth people, but he's, you know, militaristic, but he's this, but he's that, but he's this, but he's that. It was just too much. It was like, it reminded me, he almost seemed like a corporate creation, mm-hmm. in the sense that it was almost like they went to a focus group and took 10 things that people thought were cool and then tried to put them all together without any sense of, well, this is what makes the character work. So there was never a guiding vision. It was more just like, let's just take a bunch of stuff and kind of throw it at the wall.
Yeah, I would argue that, like, in these two issues and some of the early stuff that we've seen so far, there are interesting concepts being thrown out there. Like you said, kind of the cosmic militaristic side of a character who also has an appreciation for Earth culture. That's interesting. And some of the things he gets to do are visually interesting. But to me, the black hole at the center of it is Captain Mar-Vell, the character himself. He's just kind of right. Bland and uninteresting. There's really nothing about him as a character that draws you to him or makes you want to care about what's going right. on in his stories. Now, consequently, you know, despite her limited appearances here in these first few issues, I would argue immediately the most interesting thing about this book is Carol Danvers from the jump, because unlike every other female character that we've seen to this point in the Marvel Universe, whether it be Jane Foster or Gwen Stacy or Mary Jane or, you know, any other female character, this is a female character who has not just agency in her own story, but also has been trusted with a position of authority. She's kind of overseeing this base that he's on. So right away, by putting her in that role, they've distinguished her from virtually every other female in the Marvel Universe outside of perhaps Sue Storm to this point. So from a civilian perspective, they've already got something in the supporting character of Carol Danvers that will prove to be the more lasting contribution from this book than Mar-Vell himself.
To lean on a wrestling analogy, as we often do, it feels like Captain Marvel is the gimmick and Carol Danvers is the character.
Right.
It's the reason Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels stuck with people in the late 90s when all these gimmick characters did not. Mm-hmm. Because you can dream up a cool gimmick, but if you don't have someone interesting to play it, it falls flat. And I think that's what happened with Mar-Vell. Whereas Carol Danvers is all character. Mm-hmm. There's no fancy gimmicks to her. She's just a strong-willed, intelligent woman who, as you said, has agency, has a purpose, and immediately stands out. And I think maybe the most interesting thing about Carol Danvers is that she exists this early on. Mm-hmm. I would have assumed that she didn't come until later on, just because she's such a departure from the characters that we've seen in the other books, like you said. Like, it's just, you would have thought we would have gradually got there. Like, there would have been some midway steps, like slightly more developed female characters, but it's like we almost jumped straight from what we've been dealing with for most of the 60s to Carol Danvers. It's just a revelation. And it's interesting, we'll track the progression of Carol Danvers, but it's almost interesting the fact that she starts out as this kind of character, then spends years in a secondary role that she doesn't really seem suited for until she graduates to the Captain Marvel we see today, like the Kelly Sue DeConnick Captain Marvel, the one who we're going to get a movie about. That feels very much like the Carol we meet here. Mm-hmm. But I think she just took kind of like a weird detour in the decades in between her introduction and her real ascendance. So it's almost like it's weird to think that she was held back for that many years. But I agree with you. I think Carol Danvers is the best thing out of this book. It's not a coincidence that she's going to end up being the most lasting contribution to the Marvel Universe. And I think it all comes down to the fact that they thought about her personality, her values, the things that really stick. And with Captain Marvel, it was just costume and some gimmicks, and not a good costume at that. at this point, so
right,
he was a lot of potential, but I think again, just too many different things that didn't come together in a cohesive way to make a great character.
Yeah, I would agree completely.
Yeah, so let's move on from Captain Marvel and let's finish with the Hulk, mm-hmm. who after his initial 6-issue run, getting canceled, joining the Avengers, being kind of a villain in Fantastic Four and elsewhere, and then meandering through various titles not bearing his name, he now gets his own book back. Mm-hmm. And appropriately, talking to you about it, is his big first adventure here is set in Place Near and Dear to Your Heart in Asgard.
Yep.
And I would argue that the reason that the Hulk is put in Asgard to start is because, and this is probably a bit of a leap, and I'll couch it by saying I'm probably wrong, but to me it felt like them being like, all right, well, when we did the Hulk as the Hulk, he wasn't interesting, he didn't sell, and we canceled his book. When we did the Hulk as an Avenger, people were more interested. When we did the Hulk as in the Fantastic Four's world, people were more interested. So maybe if we put him in his first issue in another character's world, mm-hmm. we're kind of hedging our bets here, because even if people aren't interested in the Hulk, at least they'll be interested in Thor's supporting cast in his world. And what better setting do we have than Thor's world? It's kind of the one that works the most. That was just a crazy theory I was throwing out there.
Yeah, and plus, of established characters who have been around in the Marvel Universe to this point, as the Asgardians and Thor kind of make for the most interesting physical threat to the Hulk. Like,
absolutely.
In terms of things where he can kind of run around and find legitimate physical challenges wherever he goes, Asgard is a no-brainer. And so you barely see Thor in these two issues. It's kind of more dealing with the Asgardian side characters, which is something I always love, is when you get a chance to shine the spotlight on characters like Loki or the Warriors 3 or the Enchantress and the Executioner and characters of that ilk. So because of getting to go through the visually interesting landscape that is Asgard, and also giving the Hulk something interesting to bounce up against physically, I love these two issues, but that's a bit predictable probably coming from me.
No, but I think it's a good couple issues, and I think it's a testament to the strength of Thor comics, which to me are probably the book we neglect the most in terms of Silver Age books that are really good, because I feel like, as I've said before, Fantastic Four and Amazing Spider-Man are the obvious ones. Mm-hmm. Doctor Strange is the one that everyone's kind of discovering now. Mm-hmm. But Thor was really good.
Yeah.
Thor was really good. And I think it owes a lot to the fact that I maintain that I think it was Kirby's favorite. And I think he developed a lot of cool stuff for it. Visually, it looks better than just about anything else. And like you said, there's just this stockpile of great characters who, even if you don't use Thor, you're never going to get bored with mm-hmm. using his supporting cast and his villains,
right?
Because they're fantastic, and you know, it's modern day mythology, and it's really cool stuff. So what I'm interested in is to see the Hulk kind of stand on his own, and we see how much the character has developed over the course of the past decade. Is he the type of? Because obviously, we know. You know, just from modern context, that the Hulk's not going anywhere.
No.
He obviously resonated at some point. And, you know, he's a character who's going to become arguably behind Spider-Man, maybe for a while there, maybe the most well-known Marvel character just in terms of, like, licensing and stuff like that.
Yeah, the TV show.
So, yeah, because of the TV show. And just, like, think of like, you know, growing up. Like, Hulk was everywhere. Mm-hmm. Hulk was a character who you knew. I didn't necessarily know who Iron Man was, but I knew who Hulk was. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be interesting to see when that starts. And obviously, the thing that they're still figuring out here is he's degrading in terms of intelligence, but I'd argue he's still not in full, like,
right.
classic, dumb Hulk smash, the one that we're all familiar with.
I think the other thing is they haven't really figured out the right ratio of Banner to Hulk. Like, we're still very much in a predominantly Hulk-focused mode here, where Banner is barely right. part of his stories, and they haven't really focused in on that defining characteristic of Bruce Banner, where he has to learn how to deal with this, both this blessing and this curse he's been given, how to deal with the monster within him. We haven't really explored what that must be like to kind of be this guy who is at the mercy of his power. So I think whenever they just decide to lean into that more will probably be that moment. I can tell you from reading ahead a bit for 1969, solo Hulk stuff is not great in that year.
Yeah.
But, you know, at least they get it off to a solid start here in 68 with his own solo series again.
I think you hit on something else there. The fact that they haven't really developed the idea of using Banner for most of the comic and then having the Hulk transformation be like a big, cool moment.
Right.
Like, that's not really there yet. At this point, it's just like you said, it's more Hulk than Banner. When you can kind of build up that dramatic tension of he's Banner, and then, like, you know, last page he turns into the Hulk, that's crazy, and you start looking forward to it. And I think that maybe was something they learned with the TV show,
mm-hmm.
just because, you know, just based on effects and budget and stuff like that, he couldn't be Hulk all the time. So what I'll be curious to see is whether or not that idea of Hulk being kind of the special event, whether that predates the TV show or not, or if that's something that comes in because of the TV show. So we'll see.
Yeah, it will be. We'll be interesting to see.
So ultimately, 68 was, it was kind of a good year. There was a lot of crap. We read a lot of Avengers issues, which were not good.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we, you know, got the true high points, Silver Surfer, Nick Fury, Fantastic Four continued to be pretty good,
mm-hmm.
and some other stuff from there. But I would say we're entering an interesting time. Stan is starting to loosen the reins a little bit, and we are slowly edging towards a universe full of distinct voices. We got our first taste here with Stronko, but obviously as we move into the 70s, you're going to see a lot of contrast between guys and girls trying to do their best Stan Lee impersonations and the ones who really strike out on their own. And that's where you're going to see some characters rise to the occasion because they offer their creators an opportunity to do something different.
Yeah, I would agree. The Marvel Universe is quickly going to become a place, rather than being dominated by just a couple of creators and a few concepts, we're going to see a greater diversity in both concepts and creators here in the next few years. So we're entering a pretty interesting period over the next, I'd say, 4 to 5 years.
Yeah, for sure, man. So before we sign off for this episode, anything you want to talk about, Nick, that you got going on in your podcast empire or your digital Civilization.
Just as always, you know, hard traveling fanboys on the PlayStation Nation Pop feed.
Yep. It's out every week. I understand.
I think the most recent episode, by the time this is out, will be our countdown of our five least favorite character changes in comics history. So, talking about status quo shifts, stuff like, for example, not to give anything away, but stuff like One More Day or Emerald Twilight might pop up on my my own personal list. So, give that a listen and check out each and every week, like Ben said.
Yeah, I'm very excited to get to that episode. I'm currently in the midst of you guys' Infinity War review.
kind of review where I was sick and delirious, and we spent more time talking about other things than we did Infinity War.
It's amazing for a movie as good as Infinity War is how little time you guys spend talking about Infinity War. But I guess that kind of makes sense because when something's good, like what do you say about it other than – it's really good.
Yeah, it's really it's great. And we've already talked about it, you know, like twice in the past year. So,
yeah. So kudos to you guys for refusing to break format and taking this on, even though you may have said everything you already want to say about it.
The next Hard Travelers for Hire will be more interesting when Greg and I get to argue about Ant-Man and the Wasp.
I can't wait for that.
We feel pretty differently about that one. Not to spoil anything.
That would be fun. I'm looking forward to that. This podcast is the only podcast I do. So you can't find me anywhere else. You can find me on Twitter at Ben J. Morris. You can find me on Instagram at BenMorris882. And, of course, both of us are on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page if you want to come and talk to us there.
Absolutely.
That's all I got, man. It's good talking to you.
You too, man. Always fun.
I wish you the best. You and your family.
Thank you, sir. You as well.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Till next time. Class dismissed.
Consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. And in addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB in Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaySpeedNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebook via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySpeedNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.